It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy's here. Renee's here. Even Alex Lindsay is here to talk about next week's WWDC. What will Apple announce? The judge inadvertently gave out some secrets in the touch disease case. And Apple's iOS 11.4. It's out. What's new? We'll talk about it next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 612, recorded Tuesday, May 29th, 2018. A Walmart in a Walmart. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Wink, the best way to discover new wines you'll love. Go to trywink.com/MacBreak and get $20 off your first shipment. And by Tres Pontas, freshly roasted gourmet coffee shipped directly to you. Visit trespontas.com/MacBreak and use the code MacBreak to save 20% off every bag of coffee in your subscription. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. And there's news from Apple. Yes, indeed. Renee Ritchie is here from iMore.com and the Vector Podcast. Renee joins us every week from his studio in Montreal, where he records about 8 podcasts a day. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Leo. I seem to be laggy. I apologize. Maybe it's all the AirPlay 2.
You know how I know? Because the frame rate of your Apple TV screensaver has gone down.
Ah, that's intolerable.
Also with us, Andy Yanako of the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth. That's what I was saying.
You can tell that there's like sort of a behind the scenes beef. If like I have a screen behind me that's just doing like random static just to kill the frame, just to kill the compression rate.
Just
on
to
the
drive
screen.
Us crazy. Yeah. No, I like your Japanese paper screens. That's good. That's a good look.
It also makes you not see what a slob my work desk is.
Well, we can kind of see through the crack. I hate to tell you. there's a little gap. Mind the gap. Also with
no,
us.
No. I'm absolutely. I'm a tidy adult. I don't need someone to clean up after me.
That's the beauty of video is that you can control the frame and make sure that you don't see anything outside the frame. Also here, Alex Lindsay in studio. He's working on a 3D model of me that will allow me to phone the show in soon.
We're getting close.
That's pretty impressive.
I'll put this up.
We'll talk about it later. Yeah. That's
part of working on digitizing you for what, 15 years now?
Yeah. The first time you did it, I think, was in Canada.
No, it was in the old screensavers.
You used a magic marker to put dots on my face,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that you had points.
Right. We had to do it all by hand. Now I just had a phone look at you.
And it took a long time, a lot of pictures.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And here he did it with a few seconds with an iPhone 10 because of the cameras in the front. That's pretty, the depth sensor in the front. Hey, speaking of iPhone 10, iOS 11.4 got pushed hours ago, and it's funny, just two very important feature updates. Renee Ritchie, I know you've been working on AirPlay 2. Tell us about it.
So these are features that were originally announced back at WWDC 2017, just to give some timeline to it, and they didn't ship. And there were reasons for that. Apple kept testing iMessage Sync, for example, and kept testing AirPlay 2. And they ended up with a lot of edge cases they weren't anticipating. Like, what if people had these features set up? What are your expected behavior? If someone else tries to do it, how should it? So it ended up being a much bigger project than they thought it would be. But it was in beta testing internally at Apple for the last few months, and they've pushed it out now. And in essence, AirPlay 2 takes the same functionality as AirPlay, the ability to beam content from your iPhone, your iPad, your Mac, your Apple TV, to an AirPlay receiver. The HomePod, other AirPlay devices, speakers have the technology built in. And the new update lets you do both paired devices. So if you have two AirPods, you compare them. One becomes left, one becomes right. And then they fill a much bigger space with the same sort of computational audio. They work as a unit to make sure that everything is balanced out and that you have bias towards the left side, towards the right side, and a bigger sound stage. And also lets you do multi-room audio, which a lot of people are familiar with already from Sonos. But basically, it means you can sit there and say, I want Chuck D playing in the bedroom and the score from Greatest Show playing in the living room and just have it exactly the way you want it.
Or, and the more challenging thing is, had the same thing played in multi-rooms without having lag make it sound like you're in an echo chamber. That's really the challenge, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it has to listen and time and make sure that everything stays in sync, which is why AirPlay produces a bit of it. Like, I think there's a 2-second delay once you start playing it, and that lets it play around with the time to make sure everything stays in sync.
Oh, that's interesting. So is this something that other speakers are taking advantage of, or will they will have to get new speakers, or they'll have to get an update to take advantage of?
It's unclear. In some cases, they're probably going to be stuck on AirPlay 1 because either the manufacturer, they're old enough that the manufacturer is no longer supporting them, or they never built in an update feature.
Does it require hardware updates?
As far as I know, it's software.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there might be cases where they're running a Bluetooth modem that doesn't support it, a Bluetooth radio that doesn't support it. Hopefully that's minimal stuff, or they're not Wi-Fi equipped. There could always be something. But I think in most cases, if they make a software update available, it'll be software updatable. I don't expect many will, though, Leo. I mean, it's not a great history of accessories that you bought being upgradable.
Yeah. You can also control AirPlay from the control center now, AirPlay 2 from the control center. What new controls are there going to be?
So it depends on what you're doing. If you have a stereo pair, that presents itself as one unit. So you don't see AirPod left and AirPod right. You just see the AirPod pair now, so whatever room it's in or whatever name you give it. Like, one of my AirPods is R2 and one is BB8, but I just see the AirPod, the HomePod pairing now. If you have them in different rooms, then you'll see the different AirPods for the different rooms and you'll be able to target them separately or similarly.
Although I wonder how many people are like you and have multiple HomePods.
Very few. I mean, yeah, $350, and they just announced availability for Canada, France, and Germany, and the Canadian price, I mean, exchange is what it is, but when you still see it, you get the sticker shock of $450. So
each.
It's probably a very minimal minimal market now, but it's a technology that Apple can grow with for the next several years.
It's so funny because this week Lisa discovered our HomePod. I mean, it's been sitting in our kitchen since it came out, but she's something about it that she just really likes, and she says, I want one for my office. So but now that means if you want to use stereo pairs or multi-room, you have to have two for each room for stereo and one.
You know, so by itself is not mono. That's a common misconception. One by itself will still take all the channels available to it, analyze all the data it has, and give you the biggest soundstage possible. With two of them, though, you have two speakers to sort of make a bigger, more nuanced soundstage.
Yes.
You don't require them.
One speaker cannot do stereo, however much...
So
computation you're doing, there's this much separation. So you need to have separation.
They bounce off of walls.
Yeah,
their trick is they bounce off of walls.
What if you put like six of them in there?
Yeah, that's a good question, because that was the implication.
Will it be more and more nuanced? If I just start adding, not that I would do that.
You can't have multiple. I haven't tried a trinary pairing yet, but because there's multi-room, you can have them function as multi-room speakers. I don't know if you get this. I don't think they'll start splitting things into like a Dolby 6.1 or 7.1 stereo system fashion, but they will sort of modulate for their environment.
Yeah, I really think the bigger deal is being able to do multi-room, because if you have a budget of $700 for a pair of stereo speakers, wow, can you do so much better than any smart speaker that I've ever seen? A budget pair of good speakers that go for $300 a pair, plus a halfway decent $300 amp, I think will fill a room, give you better presence, give you better bass than either the Google Home or the HomePod. But the real cool thing is when you realize that the reason why you've been cranking up a speaker in one place is because you also want to hear it like as you're shaving in the bathroom, or you've got like the kitchen goes off the family room and you're cooking and you want to hear the same music. And so once you have the ability to simply say, I'm going to have one smart speaker in the bathroom, one smart speaker in the living room, one smart speaker in the kitchen. And that's when you realize that you didn't have to crank it up to 11 all the time. You just needed a speaker within close proximity. So this is why it's going to be even more exciting. People are going to buy a lot more. Be a lot more interested in the $350 HomePod if and when Apple figures out how to package that in a $100 or $150 package, something that is not in the featured spot in your house. It's just that, again, I want this sound to extend into my living room, into my kitchen or someplace else. Nothing has sold more Google Home speakers in my house than having multiple groups set up and having one group and basically, again, being able to fill the entire place with music without entertaining the people in the street outside.
The really cool thing is there may be an Apple HomePod Mini in the works, but they're also AirPlay 2 is a technology that they're willing to license out. So they'll be, you don't have to get a $350 HomePod necessarily. You might just get a small AirPlay speaker for the bathroom that you don't need to have all the functionality, or a Beats Pill that has the AirPlay 2 stuff built into it in the party room or something. You can almost mix and match to make exactly the capability and vendor probably that you want for the different setups.
So you also could do a handoff. So Apple says you can say, move this music into the living room and it will just move it over to the, if you have HomePods in multiple locations.
And Sonos does it, but right now, I mean, that's what I have at the house.
But you can't talk to your Sonos.
But you can't talk to it.
Well, you sort of can. I have Alexa, the one with the Echo in it, but it doesn't do much.
Right.
It doesn't do a lot of the things Echoes do.
No, I mean, I think that Sonos does it now, but it's definitely not as advanced. It's nice to be able to build. I mean, my experience is mostly Sonos because I've got a bunch of them throughout the house.
Yeah. And I use Sonos with Echoes.
And you decide you want to go through
with
it.
With Echoes,
and
you can do it because you could say, listen to, you know, right, Lord on my bathroom Sonos, and it'll play through that bathroom Sonos.
Right.
Or everywhere, which is nice. Or in my music, in my bedroom group.
But do we think that Sonos will be competitive, I guess, over time?
I think the Play 5 speakers are as good as the HomePod.
Right.
They don't have all the fancy, you know, multi-directional drivers and all of that, but I think it's as good as a HomePod.
I like being able to design. Mine are all just the controllers that go back to speakers.
Right.
So
that's the best way.
So there's
then you
stacks
have great speakers, right?
Exactly.
All right, so you can play music at the same time in multiple rooms. You can control your audio system through your house. You can use Siri to move stuff around. The lock screen, control center, all are now AirPlay 2 enabled. You could take a call. This is another one. This is from the Apple Notes. Take a call or play a game on your phone without interrupting playback on your speakers. I didn't know that was a problem. So if I'm playing back on AirPlay and I get a phone call, the speakers stop playing music. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, the old version.
The old version. Now they will continue to play. HomePod pairs, left, right, automatically sense their location in the room, balance the sound based on locations. Beamforming provides a wider sound stage, bouncing off the walls. And HomePods will automatically update unless updates are disabled in the Home app. So there you go. That's AirPlay 2. Let's talk about messages in iCloud, because actually this is something a lot of people have wanted, something you've had with most other messaging apps if they have desktop support, multi-phone support, a Facebook Messenger for sure. So what does messages in iCloud do for you, Renee?
It's a little bit different. And first, it's opt-in. I believe it's off by default.
You have an article on how to turn it on. So that's something people should. Yeah.
So the previous model of iMessage was in many ways constrained by Apple's security model, and there was all sorts of annoyances that came with that, including groups that fractured because one person didn't have the other person's email address but had their phone number or vice versa into it, and they wouldn't allow you to see that contact because that was leaking information. So there's all sorts of sort of design decisions that were based around security, and one of them was that it didn't sync messages because in order to maintain the end-to-end encryption, what it would do was try to deliver a unique version of that message to every device for 10 days. And if it couldn't deliver it, it would just stop trying. So your devices, what you had on a device depended on that unique version of the message getting there. And now what Apple has built out is a secure version of iCloud, basically, which is built on CloudKit that handles the encryption end-to-end within that infrastructure. And the messages now go there where they're centralized and then synced across all your various devices, so they stay connected. And that means that if you delete it on one device, previously it was not deleted on other ones because, again, each of them had a unique copy. But now it'll start doing things like making sure all the messages are in the same place. If you delete them, it'll delete them across. So if you're used to the old behavior, there will be some sort of changes. You'll have to make just your own thought process. But in all, it'll make sure, just like an IMAP email box, every message you have in one device is mirrored across all your devices, and any changes you make are mirrored across those devices as well.
So contrary to what you might think, this is not a setting in messages. I was looking for it in messages and couldn't find it. Go to settings, tap your head, and then go to iCloud, and now there's a new on-off switch in messages. And as you can see, by default, it's off. So if I turn this on on my iPad, will it turn it on everywhere I have 11.4 installed?
I haven't actually tried that, but what it should do is take the contents of your messages on that iPad and suck them up into the secure iCloud,
okay.
Secure CloudKit infrastructure, and then make sure those messages are balanced across other devices.
So once you get 11.4, if you want to use iCloud messaging, and I think most people will want to, that's if you have multiple Apple devices, it seems to me a no-brainer, then you'll want to go into your iCloud settings, which you get to by tapping on your head. Or what? Whatever it is you have.
Wouldn't it be great if you could just tap on your head? Just a little.
And they did test it. I mean, one of the reasons it took so long is that they kept testing it to make sure that people didn't, because data destruction is an end break, is a game breaker for this kind of stuff. Sorry, deal breaker.
That's right.
So they would test it and make sure nobody lost messages or nobody unintentionally deleted them or they didn't lose state and all those things. And now they would put it in the beta and then take it out of the release and put it in the beta and keep testing it until they were sure it was, you know, as rock solid as they could, and now it's
so
available.
The thing that there were, I guess I'll test because I've installed 11.4 on my iPad, and I'm doing it right now on my iPhone, is whether it will merge the messages from the different devices into one big iCloud
store.
It
should. You should have a unified set of conversations when you're finished.
That would be nice. Oh, see, it won't. It says updating to iCloud paused. Plug in your device and connect to Wi-Fi. It won't do it unless you're plugged in. Even though this has a 75% charge, it won't do it until I'm plugged in and connected to Wi-Fi. That's ridiculous.
Wi-Fi. Usually does. It might think that once in a while it believes that an update is big enough that if it drains you of power, something really bad will happen.
This isn't the update. This is iCloud message uploading.
Oh, interesting. I've been on it since the beta. I don't recall that.
Yeah. I turn it on, as you saw in my settings, and then I went to messages, and it says updating to iCloud paused. Plug in your device and connect to Wi-Fi. I am on Wi-Fi, but that's fine. I'm not in a big hurry.
I think they did that for photos, and they do that initially for apps as well when you're syncing a new device.
It could be years worth of messages, right? I mean, if you keep
some people
forever.
Some people have gig. I mean, my mom sends me like 8 or 9 different Bitmoji every morning, and I'm sure there's like 8 gigs.
That's something to be aware of, too. If you have iCloud storage and you're paying for it, you may not have enough or it may fill it up suddenly.
It's also local. It takes up a lot of people's local device storage. So previously, it would be like best practice would be to delete a lot of old messages. And some of them auto-expire now, too, content to make it more helpful. But a lot of people have just gigs of stuff in there.
Wow. There is a new version of tvOS as well. Is this related?
So you, in order to use AirPlay 2, you have to update your iPhone, for example, to 11.4. Then you have to update your HomePod. It will do it automatically, but you can go into the Home app, tap on software updates and force the update. And in order to use the AirPlay 2 on the Apple TV, you have to update to tvOS 11.4 as well. And you know all your devices have to get all of today's updates. Nothing for the Mac yet. Sadly, there's no AirPlay 2. Mac already has multi-room capabilities, but it's not specifically getting AirPlay 2 yet.
Oh, interesting. Unfortunately, I started the update on, I had all the notes. Apple, you really should fix this. Before you do the update, you can read all the notes about what's in the update. But as soon as you do the update, those notes are gone.
Yeah, remember they used to do an animated thing where it would come up and say, while we're updating, here's everything that's new and exciting about.
And I can't find it on the Apple support pages.
It was a bit of a morning, Leo, because one publication put it up on Eastern time instead of Central time. So it was 3 hours early. And then they took it down and then somebody else put it up. And then everybody decided to put it up. But the update wasn't ready. But all the articles were written as though they were ready. So it was a bit of a morning.
So there are, you have the notes. I'm sure you cut and paste them and did something smart and kept them around.
I do.
There's more than just AirPlay 2 and messages in the cloud. Those are the two big marquee features. But tell us about some of the other features.
I don't have them in front of me.
See, I thought you would have the notes, and I had them, and then unfortunately, it started installing, and they're gone.
They have the usual plethora of security fixes.
There's the security stuff, but there were some other new features too, which they're not getting a lot of coverage, unfortunately. And Apple's support note doesn't talk about it. Yes, Mr. Inotko.
They added a couple of things just to support all the classroom features that they introduced.
Classroom, that was it. Yeah.
So basically now teachers, they're using the classroom app can now use iBooks as part of the curriculum, use that to monitor what they're reading, that sort of stuff.
That's nice. Nice of them.
Yeah, I'm looking at the...
you got the notes.
Don't
no no. I'm looking at the press release for my inbox.
Oh, there you go.
Because I haven't installed it yet, but I have to say that Joanna Stern has the best take so far, because she was highlighting in the boilerplate, we're saying, and you can do so many other things with it, like set a timer, and Joanna's like, really? Can we do like more than one timer finally on with Siri? It's like, for heaven's
sake. That's funny. So yeah, it's probably a worthwhile thing to get. I don't know specifically if it fixes.
I believe it's either 11.3 or 11.4 that will alert you if a website asks you for your username and password and they're not on HTTP. I don't remember because I've been on the beta since the launch, but it's either 11.3 or 11.4 made that change, which is really helpful. Some people are upset with Chrome because it'll alert you no matter what if you're on an HTTP connection. And some people believe that breaks the web because, you know, old web pages and archives, and the web should be free and people shouldn't have to have an HTTPS certificate. So what Apple's doing instead is it will only alert you if it asks for your credentials and the connection isn't secure.
I think that's the right way to do it. But of course, because Google says this is going to impact your search listings,
yeah,
they're using their strong arm to force everybody to go to HTTPS. We had to... Now, the good news is for a lot of simple sites, you can use Let's Encrypt and it's free. And I agree, HTTPS is a good thing. The web should have been designed that way from the first place. But it is a bit of a burden on everybody. We had to do it. We had to pay for certs, HTTPS certs for the Tech Guy Lab site and the Twit site. It's not,
there are a lot of archival sites that just aren't maintained and are never going to get that update. And now they're going to warn people that they're insecure and it'll cause a lot of confusion.
Yeah. I mean, what I think the unintended consequence is people are going to start ignoring those warnings.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's exactly what you don't want.
Well, it's also remember that a lot of these unattended sites might be running like old versions of a CMS, old versions of WordPress, might have had code injected into them. So I don't think there's a right way to do it. I think that Apple's way is probably better in the long run, just for the reasons that you say. The more false positives you get, the less likely it is you are to respond to a honking car alarm by calling the police. But there's a bunch of different ways to navigate this.
Yeah. So when you move stuff to iCloud, does it move it off of your device messages?
No, I believe it's still everything that is local to the device will stay local. Apple typically uses what they call it. They don't call this, but in the industry it's called nearline, which means that the things that are more recent and frequent are stored locally, and the things that are older and infrequent are stored on the cloud. But I haven't seen any large scale iMessage reduction in storage capacity yet.
That's too bad, because like your mom would benefit, right?
I would, because she's the one sending me all those pictures.
Oh.
There was a story a while ago about bringing messaging. I think it was Google brought messaging to India, and everyone immediately started sending everybody like 10 good morning messages. They started running out on bandwidth.
Massive.
We never expected. That's what my family's been like for years, Leo. My sister and my mom, it's like that.
It comes from an Indian family. Many people don't know. All right. Well, the good news is it's a small update. It downloads quickly and installs quickly. So it's already installed.
Super interesting is they got it out ahead of WWDC. It's one of those things where they clear the deck so that they have, because the keynote is already chock-a-block. So
that's a very good
point. They want to get all the old stuff out of the way before the new stuff kicks in.
So just to give, follow up here, messages in the iCloud is not turned on the phone. So you will have to turn it on every device that you want it on. That's a per-device setting, not a global setting for your iCloud.
So you're involved in illegitimate chocolate smuggling and you don't want any trail.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. That's exactly right. You don't necessarily want everything moved up to the cloud on every device. I do. I would like everything to be unified. And that's the other thing. I'm curious if it will propagate messages that were only on my iPad.
I believe it does. I'll have to double-check that, but I believe it does.
Good. All right, there's 11.4, and you can get it now for iOS, for iPad and iPhone. There is a tvOS update. Is there a watch update as well? Is that coming?
Yes. Or?
There is. Everything's updated.
I don't think the Mac update is live yet. I'll have to double check, but it wasn't live.
Oh, there'll
live.
Be a Mac update too. Okay.
I believe the Mac update is coming too, but sometimes that's a little bit later.
That does kind of imply that we're not, not that we were expecting to see new hardware at WWDC, but... If there was new hardware that required new operating system updates, they probably would have held the new OS until then. So it's another data point against if you're waiting for a new iPod in June.
Okay, so maybe not new iOS devices, but they are holding on to the Mac OS update.
I would still suspect iPad is probably one of the more likely updates for Dub.
You think they'll be in?
Slip. I mean, it's so hard to tell because so many things slip these days, but it just seems like we had the iPads and Skylake Max last year, so we could have the A11 iPads and Coffee Lake. Intel might have announced three other processor optimizations since then, but Coffee Lake, MacBooks, and iMacs.
So this is, we'll be streaming this live Monday, 10 a.m. If you want to come in, Alex, if you're around. I think you're out of town.
I'm out of town.
Yeah. I wonder where he's going. Yeah, I'm sure it's Cleveland. So we were talking about this on iOS today this morning, and I maybe have gave Megan some bad advice because I said, I don't think there'll be an iPad update. You think there will be?
I think, again, there's so much of this stuff has slipped to the fall lately that I would never bet money on it, but I also would never buy something right before WWDC.
I think Leo, you need to order some equipment. That's what we need.
You want it for sure, Leo. You got to buy it.
Just to set this all up correctly.
Well, I know the thing I'm waiting for is a MacBook Pro with a real keyboard. I want this 15-inch.
Yeah.
I want a MacBook Air or a MacBook with that keyboard. That's never going to happen, I know, but that's what I
think
want.
Think Mac Mini. Order a Mac Mini this week.
Mac Mini?
We need one. We all got to do it for the kids.
Join the real world, my friend. There's not going to ever be an update for the Mac
Mini. You want an ARM Mac Mini, dream. Alex?
If there is one, it'll be an ARM. The interesting thing is today Dell announced its 15-inch XPS based on this new Kaby Lake G. This is the new Intel processor, the one we'd heard of that had the unholy alliance of Intel CPU and AMD GPU in one chip. It's basically discrete GPU in
a
single.
Silicon that dare not speak its name.
Yes. Kaby Lake G. And so that is now available because Dell is making it in their laptops. That is also coincidental, don't you think, timing to the fact that next Monday, 10 a.m., Tim Cook and Phil Schiller and the gang are going to take the stage. I think they're going to announce. I'm hoping a Kaby Lake G.
It's just such a weird time. Intel really hit a brick wall with 14 nanometer, and it's so hard to predict. Like, we're talking about Kaby Lake G in a year where we were supposed to be talking about Cannon Lake, and now we still have Coffee Lake and, I forget, Whiskey Lake and Ice Lake and all these other things.
We're way
behind.
And
it's so confusing to see where Intel is going, and there's been a bunch of articles this week saying that maybe Intel is not going anywhere, which is sad given how big a lead they had in this space.
Ice Lake, by the way, is the Canadian-only version of the Intel chips, I believe.
I can't tell anymore because they were going to do a split desktop laptop strategy where one went to 10 nanometer and one stayed at 14 nanometer, and it's getting more and more complex. It used to be, remember that it was TikTok, it would be a process shrink and then an architecture change. And now it's TikTok, optimize. Okay, optimize. We don't know if there'll be another TikTok.
But don't you think this AMD GPU with an Intel CPU is right up Apple's alley because Apple's all in on AMD, right? Partner for the Radeons for their GPU. This would be a natural for a pro laptop.
Right.
So
I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
Plus all the stuff that's being pushed off to GPUs these days, the idea of having a hybrid CPU like that, that's such an easier, we were talking about last week about how one of the big difficulties of designing a really high powerful CPU is that electrons are way too big and chunky for the speed they're trying to get out of them. And one of the ways around that is to work on these more clever hybrid designs, and a combination CPU GPU on one single component is a really good way to get at that.
Mm-hmm. And the G is designed for laptops.
Yeah.
So I'd be willing to put money, or at least a fine bottle of wine, on the new MacBook Pros this week.
If it ships with this plus a T chip, then you'd have ARM plus Intel plus AMD all in the same.
What a weird combination, huh? Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that we're going to see new MacBook Pros. I don't know if we'll see new MacBook Airs or MacBooks, but I guess that.
MacBook Air, probably not. The Air is probably a September.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Plus, I think that the consumer MacBook line is a subject of much ambitious discussion right now. and that any more time that they can get to before holding off on telling us what their plans are, the better. I'm keen to see if they do talk about a brand new MacBook, if they at least talk about, without admitting any fault whatsoever, given now two class action lawsuits, they say, and don't worry, the butterfly keyboard that you love already is going to be even better.
Yeah, butterfly 3, right?
Or something new.
I'd be surprised. It doesn't feel like something Apple wants.
Ever shipped. Yeah. 100% of all Mac, almost 99% of all MacBooks we sold last year were with this keyboard design. The people have spoken. But they might have to encourage people to keep the faith, either that they are going to make this into an option or they're continuing to evolve it. They're going to continue to improve it, that the original design wasn't bad, but there's always ways to make things better. And they're committed to making sure this is their future keyboard design, if that is indeed their plan.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting. And you think, Renee, for sure iPads.
I mean, again, nothing is for sure, but we got the new iPads with the 10.5 and the 12.9 update, the A10 updates last year. And it seems like, you know, A11 updates, FaceTime, all those sort of things. Sorry, not FaceTime, Face ID, all those sort of things are in the pipeline. And
Not have heard rumors from the supply chain by now about this?
Probably. I just don't ever want to discount any of those. I mean, I would personally prefer it when there's no new hardware at WWDC. I like to spend time with the software, but most people these days get excited about hardware, not software.
Yeah. And you're saying they announced the iPad Pros at WWDC last year?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't remember that. All right, so it is not unprecedented for them to announce both laptops and tablets at WWDC.
They just, whatever the next show is, if the stuff is ready, it goes. Like, they never hold anything back, and they can't ship something that's not ready. So WWDC is the next event that they can.
So they're not thinking, this is a developer conference, let's not say something that's consumer focused. They don't. That's not in the calculation at all. Okay,
I agree. Everything they ship is supported by developers, so technically everything is a developer release.
That's true.
And I totally agree with Renee. I never believe anything that is rumored or that I might even be suspecting about a announcement until I'm watching the stage and I see the thing either appear or not appear. That said, I have not seen anything that I would have expected to see by now if there were a new iPad arriving next week. Certainly they could certainly announce something, but I'd be surprised right now at this if they were to say, and it'll be ready to order in 1 week from today.
The
iPad is super interesting because we went from having one 6 months apart from the iPhone iPad 3 to iPad 4 because that processor, and then we've been like 18 months between updates too. Like, they came out in the spring or in the summer or in the fall. So we could just as easily go to the fall. But I hate guessing about Dub Dub because 1 year the rumor was, you know, Apple TV was primed, ready to go. And then, it's coming out in the fall. And then 2 years ago it was, MacBook Pro, finally, it's ready. It's coming out in the fall. So
yeah, as long as we issue the caveat that Apple doesn't say, and no one really knows what Apple's going to do, they might have something the day before they're ready to announce that they pull at the last minute. So there's really no way of saying with any certainty at all about what Apple will do on Monday.
And sometimes they don't know. I mean, the last few updates have been significantly delayed by Intel's roadmap because they're waiting for specific versions of those chips.
I'm waiting for a levitating self-driving car. If I don't get that on Monday,
keep waiting. Project Titan. Set, man, so. There might be a VW bug, though, apparently.
Oh, there you go.
All right. All right, I'm holding on to a little packet of change if they did come up with a better keyboard, because I'm still using the 2015 MacBook Pro, which is fine. Actually, I really shouldn't buy a new one because I have zero complaints. You're using it too. I have zero complaints about it. It's a great laptop.
Works for what I need.
And it's fine. It's fast. I'm using it with Photoshop as well as everything else, and it's fast. Well, it's not super fast, but it's fast enough. Mm-hmm.
I think that for the immediate future, the best solution, if you have lots and lots of money, is to contact Ben Heck.
He's available.
Buy a brand new top of the line MacBook. Send it to him and say, I want you to rebuild this inside a case that has at least three standard USB ports. I want a real keyboard.
Could you do that? Could I take the guts of a MacBook and put it in a better case?
You could certainly do that. I am the owner of a MacBook that I can't use anymore because, again, some idiot spilled soda into the keyboard. And so I've been looking at, what if I were to take this apart, rebuild this into a different case, and make it like a put like a hidden USB connection between a keyboard that I like and the main board. And there's ways to do it. You basically have to trick, as far as I've been able to tell, as far as an engineer has told me, you'd have to trick the MacBook into thinking that the old keyboard is still connected while you also have a second keyboard attached through USB. It was complicated enough that I got distracted by a bright, shiny object before I started the CNC machine going. But you could do that. And remember that Apple used to actually have authorized, I don't know what they call them, but remember there used to be versions of like the tablet aluminum G4 that people were authorized to, again, starting off with an actual factory bought PowerBook G4, they would rebuild it behind a touchscreen that would be emulating a standard mouse and basically give you a tablet Mac.
Boy, I would pay good money for the guts are fine. I would love that just a better keyboard on that thing.
The rebuild, it really is phenomenal what people are doing. We're not just talking about, I'm going to take like an old Atari 2600, take the board out and put it inside something smaller with a clamshell LCD case. But we're talking about communities that are forming around like very sophisticated game consoles and actually taking a saw to the board, figuring out that, okay, all of this is just power, so we can literally saw this all off. Right here is memory that we can saw off and then remap to someplace else, resulting in a board that used to be about the size of maybe an index card now being about the size of like five postage stamps. And if that community ever got around rebuilding Macintoshes, like PowerBooks, MacBooks, that would be super interesting. The idea of having a custom-made MacBook what could you do if you had a MacBook that was 1 inch thick? And the only mandate I'm giving you is that it can be no thinner than 1 inch thick, and give me as much comfort and convenience as possible without exceeding, let's say, 90 pounds. I don't know. That would be an interesting mandate for someone. And if I win the $500 million Powerball someday, I'm definitely going to commission four different people to do that for me.
Is this real? The ModBook Pro?
Yeah, that was an older one where they put a touchscreen on it. That was a few years. But can you imagine a Netflix show like Fastest Cars where you have one Apple Store MacBook versus a bunch of homemade MacBooks? Winner takes all. It'd be a great show.
Oh, man. Okay. Monday, 10 a.m., Megan Maroney and I will be doing our customary annotation of the keynote stream. You could tune in at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 1700 UTC on Monday. And then the next day, we'll all talk about it. I don't know, Renee, will you be able to join us? Probably not, huh?
No. I'm stuck in South Bay, sadly. But I'll be back the next week.
Okay. And Andy, you will, though. You're not going out.
I am staying very much put, yes.
Yes. And Alex, you're busy because, well, gosh, something's going on that week, I'm sure.
Traveling all week.
All week.
He's with the Avengers. He's with the Avengers all week.
The Iowa Regional Shoe Repair Coalition, that's a big conference. There's over 8,000 people going to be there at the convention center.
Yep. I could actually buy this ModBook Pro, it looks like.
You know, not to get off topic, if I was Alex, I would just pick everything I loved in the world and get myself at, like, oh, Disney, you need help with this. Oh, Nike, you need help with that. Lego, yeah, I'll be there. Yeah,
exactly.
Mod your own.
That'd be great.
Hello, Tasty Cake Factory. I think that someone should document the process of making those delicious lemon little pies that you make. I might have to be like embedded for 3 months to make sure I get all the footage I need. Yes.
Milk bar, I'm going to stream that crack cake to everybody in the world.
I think we should document how whiskey is made. I think that would be very good.
I can show you how wine is made. I can show you how, because our sponsor, Wink, makes their own wine. Amazing wine. And we went down actually to the Wink headquarters in Los Angeles and I met the winemaker. They actually work with many winemakers all over the world to make some amazing wines, and then you subscribe and you get your wines by mail in the lovely Wink box. This is our box, actually. Lisa and I get four bottles a month. That's about right, one a week. Not that we're going to drink them all. We, you know, maybe a couple of romantic dinners, we open a bottle of wine, then we got a bottle of wine to put away for future in our little mini wine cellar, and then maybe a bottle of wine to bring to friends when we go out, or we visit their houses. We just love these wines. Let's see what's in the Wink case today. Tempo Vero This is a wine from with wild beaches, ancient forests, and tempting local cuisine. The wine region of Salento in the heel of Italy's boot. Isn't that cool? A southern Italian wine. This is going to be a nice big red, I have a feeling. If you go to the site, trywinc.com/MacBreak, you could take their short little taste test. This is to figure out what your taste buds like. How do you take your coffee? With cream and sugar, plain? What do you like? Or I don't drink coffee. You could do citrus, umami with the mushrooms, berries. What flavors do you like? Once they figure it out, they're going to put together a selection for you. You choose. This is, you know, the default is two whites, two reds. We always get all reds because Lisa doesn't like whites all that much. I think the summertime, you got to get a little bit of white, especially. They're very, very popular. They have a white that everybody just loves. There's summer water. It's not really a white. It's a rosé. Yeah, summer water rosé. Here's Frappato. I think Lisa did all Italians. Oh, no. Here's a French one from the Costerie de Nîmes AOC. So, L'Atelier du Sud. So, they have wines from all over the world. Incredible. I just love Wink. Why drink the same old bottle every day when you could try some wines personalized for you? Just take their palate profile quiz. They send wines curated to your taste. The more wines you rate, the more personalized your monthly selections. Wink works directly with top winemakers and growers from around the world. They make all their own wine each month, new delicious wines. They also partner with local artists. The labels are always beautiful. So these are always welcome as gifts, too. I mean, they really are gorgeous. Look at these. It's kind of hard sometimes for me to just choose four. Shipping is covered. And if you don't like a bottle they send you, they'll replace it, no questions asked, with a bottle you'll love. Oh, the Folly of the Beast Pinot Noir. That's my style of wine. Sit back, relax, or celebrate with Wink. Why settle for the same bottle of wine you always get? Discover great wine today. Go to trywinc.com/MacBreak for $20 off your first shipment. trywinc.com/MacBreak. The best wine. And it's fun to try new wines, I have to say. And man, we have found some wines that we just now, and I probably shouldn't do this, we just order every month. We always say, well, you got to have a bottle of that. What is the one that we just love? It's so good. It's a Austrian style. Oh, so delicious. W-I-N-C is Wink. trywinc.com/MacBreak. $20 off. You're going to love it. Thank you, Wink, for great wines. Lots of Apple news today besides iOS 11.4. Samsung loses in court and must pay Apple, it's a pittance, $539 million for infringing iPhone patents. This is a jury trial. It's about halfway. They compromise between Apple and Samsung. Samsung, though, is a little upset. $500 million. The bulk of the damages, $533 million for infringing three Apple design patents. The remainder, $5.3 million for two utility patents. There was no question Samsung had already been found to infringe the patents. The trial was really all about the damages. Samsung had fought the earlier damage findings. And, in fact, had got it down, I think, to $399 million. Nope, you're going to have to pay a little bit more.
Well, they're going to keep it in court for probably another two or three
years. Yes. Samsung says, the fight is not over. Today's decision flies in the face of a unanimous Supreme Court ruling in favor of Samsung on the scope of design patent images. We'll consider all options to obtain an outcome that does not hinder creativity and fair competition for all companies and consumers. They're fighting for us. Oh, they're fighting for all of us.
Thank goodness.
I mean, it's the cheapest amount of money they could have spent on the R&D that let them quickly make it.
I actually agree with you. They should just say, hey, we got a deal. Thank you. It worked out fine.
Here's a check. It's 1% of our daily profit.
Yeah.
We'll sell three more toilets tomorrow.
But on top of that, however much it costs to litigate, I bet they're making so much more money just basically holding on to that $500 million and whatever they've got the money in. Like if they whatever like investments they've got the $500 million in, they've probably got that funding the continuation of the lawsuit, and there's probably going to be just some spreadsheet that says, okay, at this point we're not making as much money off of what's left over as we are fighting this, so at this point, yes, we'll cut them a check, we'll raise the price of side-by-side refrigerators for three quarters and make up for it.
And also, I'd love for Samsung just to get behind. I mean, there was a time where Samsung was just shameless. They made a BlackBerry, they made a Blackjack, they made ports that looked like dock connectors for no reason. They made everything they could. That was what you did in the utility industry. Refrigerators looked like refrigerators, whatever. But then with the Galaxy Note, and then after that, they started making such unique, such really, like Samsung started owning their own design. And this sort of harkens back to an era before that. And I think it would behoove them, yeah, just as a company, to sever all of those titles, get all of that behind them, and then go on and keep making awesome Samsung stuff.
Samsung had argued that $28 million was fair. Apple wanted $1.07 billion. There was a little bit of a...
They met in the middle.
The jury was just like, let's just cut it down the center.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, Sina had interviewed a few of the jurors, and they were not ignorant about technology. One of the jury foreperson was a manager at a Barnes & Noble, but one of the jurors was a technical writer for Cisco. And they both agreed that Apple had really pioneered it. So it's, you know, it's an interesting case.
So what happened was Samsung said, yes, cut it in half. Apple said, no, we don't want you to cut it in half. Just let Samsung have everything. And so in the end, they gave it.
Yeah. And in fact, it was the older phones because the jury was asked specifically to assign damages for each phone. And they actually did. The big one was the Droid Charge. Or the Galaxy S4G. The Galaxy S2.
Galaxy S2 was the one that Verizon didn't have an iPhone and desperately wanted one.
I love that Droid Charge came down to $54,839 and $113. Like, how do you come up with $113?
There must have been some. I don't know.
74 was the new margarita machine for the base. Yes. But yeah, well, like there's a lot to love on both sides here. Where I think Samsung was right to defend because a lot of the chargers were kind of ridiculous. That there was parts of it where Apple was kind of saying that no, here's a device that has a home button and rounded rectangles and pocket sized devices that's dominated by a screen. And okay, well, what about these other devices that way predate the iPhone that do that? Oh well, but on the other hand, for heaven's sakes, it's like you got your hand in the cookie jar, you got crumbs all over your face and your shirt. At some point, you say, okay, it's a fair cop. I will sit in the corner for 3 days. There were points in which they were actually like copying the actual icons. Where there was, I don't know if there was intent to defraud or deceive, but there was a lack of interest in innovation, let's say, in the designs of their first entries into Android touchscreen phones. So I agree with Renee. I think that if I really wish that Samsung would write that check. At some point you do your 30 hours of community service, then you take off the orange vest, you put away the trash picker, and then you move on with your life. I think that's what they should do.
Here are the three patents, and again, it was already decided that Apple's patents were infringed. I'm not sure I agree with that. This was a damages trial. This is one of the patents was on a phone with rounded rectangles and a black face. This is the other one. You recognize these. These are the like original iPhones. These are pretty old. And then the third patent was on the grid of icons on the screen.
that's kind of a reach.
All of them feel fairly generic. I don't know how you would design a phone that didn't kind of look like that.
It's a ludicrous journey to get to a sensible place.
Again, that's it. They're also suing Geos for Atari ST. They're also suing cigarette machines that had buttons in a grid. That's okay.
No, they're not. But Samsung has some deeper pockets.
Well, Samsung, it felt like it was a personal insult, right? Like going all the way back to Steve. Yeah. It's like we made this phone. We partnered with Google and Samsung to do it, and now they've launched Android and Galaxy. And damn it, it hurts. So we're gonna make them.
Yeah. This is very much a Sonny Corleone sort of thing, where there's a consigliere somewhere saying, Steve, this is business. You're letting this get me personal. This is just about business.
Yeah.
Well, and it's all the baggage of Windows. I mean, it's a thing.
I think it's also a little bit like, in the scene in Unforgiven where where he beats the you know, beats mercilessly the guy who yes. you know, he's like, I'm not talking, I'm not beating you, I'm English not beating Bob. Him, I'm beating, I'm telling everybody
Bet
else
you think
this
I'm
is
picking
a bad
you,
idea.
Bob. So. Right. What I'm actually doing is talking.
Yeah.
Talking
yeah.
to every bow-legged trail tussin that there ain't no money to get here.
Yeah.
And if there were, well, you wouldn't want to come here and try to get it, would
yeah.
you?
Exactly. So I think that there's a little bit of, we're just going to keep this going because every time it gets a little PR, people, you know, everybody else who might want to copy something is reminded that Apple will hang on to this and so tenaciously. And I think that both companies can afford to win or lose this case, but the reminder that that the company is litigious is probably useful for Apple.
Apple is responding as everybody is this week to GDPR Friday. GDPR.
You think this is the new 2K?
Y2K. I don't know. We had to do it. I'm sure you had to do it. Any company that has a website has to at least consider GDPR.
It's really unclear exactly what you have to do in many cases.
Well, it isn't, but it would be prudent to at least do something. We yes. revised our privacy policy, reconsidered our data retention policies, changed those, shortened the amount of time. Any company
that USA Today that went to like a Lynx version of their website.
Yeah, it's interesting because the original the USA Today website you get in outside of the EU is 5.4 megabytes.
Yeah.
The one you get inside the EU is 542K, right. And that's because they took all of the stuff, all of the it ad was. Trackers and everything.
No.
But then there's the newspapers like the Tronc papers, L.A. Times and the Chicago Tribune, the Arizona Star. There are a lot of newspapers that just block EU users. Just
Because it's I think that's just what they have to do right now. It's hard to overstate how difficult a problem this is. It's not just talking to your own IT department and making sure that your own site or your own property conforms to all the stuff. There's also every single service that you contract with to do your IT. Every single bit of code that every single piece of code that you have incorporated. If your IT department is using a framework, you have to now make sure that you're coordinating with the developers of that framework to make sure that you know exactly what this thing is doing. And so that's why I don't think they're going to I certainly don't think they're going to shut off access to EU users forever. But until there was a hard deadline with no excuses and no extensions. And if given the extreme punishments that the EU can hand down for violating this, there's just really only one answer. If you, it is just like Alex has said, this really is like Y2K. A lot of companies started preparing for this before this plan was made official. This was made official in 2012, 2013, I think. And so there are a lot of people that just weren't ready for it. And so there's a lot of people that are just standing by, just like in Y2K, standing by to see if their computers would shut down or not because they just ran out of time and there was no way to get an extension to this.
Well, and I wonder.
I saw a great conversation.
Go ahead, Ray.
I saw a great conversation between two developers, one of whom said, "This is fantastic. It's the best thing ever. I'm finally seeing what all these scummy websites and apps have been collecting about me forever." The other developer said, "This is the worst nightmare I could imagine because I'm not concerned about what I'm doing, but I'm concerned that if I make a clerical error or I misinterpret something or they interpret it differently than how it was originally stated, I'm going to be an example lawsuit and I'm going to lose everything that I ever had." And like somewhere yeah. in the middle, there's a truth, but there's very different reactions.
And I doubt the EU is going to come down hard on people who, you know, aren't. I think it's really aimed at Facebook and Google and companies like that. But, you know, it is fairly onerous. I would imagine millions of man hours were spent last week. Certainly we spent 40 or 50 trying to figure out what to do. We rewrote our privacy policy, which, as I said, changed our data retention policies. Any website that collects IP addresses, which is virtually every website, has to consider this. If you get emails, if you have an email newsletter, that means you're getting people's emails, collecting them. You have to do something about this.
Well, and e-privacy is right behind it.
You know, yes, the new one is e-privacy, which maybe even is more draconian. I have very mixed feelings about it because I think it's also good for users. For instance, Apple had to update its privacy. You can go to privacy.apple.com and log in with your Apple ID, and you can see what Apple's doing. But you can also download or correct your data, and this is all GDPR required. The good news is Apple, like most companies, has decided to extend it to not just people living in the EU, but everybody. So
I do wonder. Surprising, because I went to Google's version of this, and I have turned off everything that I could possibly turn off over the years for Google. And I went there and all of it was on, and I had to go and repause it all. And it turned out that previously it depended like what device you did it on, whether it be that device or globally. And in most cases, it was never globally. And there was like three or four different versions you had to turn off. And now it's all in one place. And if you don't want to share anything, you can make absolutely sure you're not sharing anything. So in that, in cases like that, it's a huge boon, I think, for consumers.
And I wonder though, is it, you know, there's, when you listen to the startup process of a lot of companies that, that got off the ground, like Instagram, you know, they have a good example of just kind of like, it just kind of accidentally worked, you know, and then they had a, and then they had a server, and then they, you know, suddenly a lot of people were using it and the server crashed, you know, and I wonder whether those kind of companies could start up in this environment, especially with the e-privacy coming. And I also wonder whether some startups may start to just go, well, we're just going to block, you know, there might be a lot of things like we're just going to block Europe. When we start up. Now, if we're successful, we'll incorporate them later, or we'll have a much more cut down version, or much more, you know, like they're, you know, I could see how European users may get greatly affected if it's not, you know, you start targeting certain countries as opposed to trying to incorporate Europe because it's too troublesome. The question is whether you could do that anyway. I mean, what happens when they travel? Are you blocking the IP addresses, or are you blocking their credit card address? You know, those types of things.
So here's Apple's page. If in a few easy steps you can ask for access to your data, this is a little confusing. If your account is set for a country outside the EU, Iceland, Norway, Liechtenstein, or Switzerland. So I guess the rules are different. So I'm going to say I'm in the United States.
They deployed it for the EU immediately on May 24th. It's going to come to other regions, but it's not in every region yet. So if you're in the EU, you get everything. You get change your data, download your data, all of those things. If you're not, you might just get one or two functions for now. But over the summer, they're going to be rolling it out for all geos.
So you can. So it's asking me to email them for access to data if my account is outside those of those countries. So if you're inside those countries, you can.
I had deactivate and one other option. I did not have change data. I did not have download data yet.
Yeah. So at some point you'll be able to download your data.
And it's interesting. Like it's your iTunes purchases. Like it's not.
Apple doesn't know that much about me.
It's a surprisingly small amount of data.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm not going to send an email to Apple. You can also
delete. It takes
delete
like
your,
a week or something.
You can delete your account. Can you do that even if you're not in the EU?
Yeah, I don't know if the wording is delete or deactivate. I think you have both options in the EU, but I think you only have one option.
Here in the US, it says delete. At any time or for any reason, you can request to permanently delete your account. For your security, we verify all deletion requests. It takes up to 7 days. And they tell you all the consequences, all the things you won't be able to do.
And there was some confusion. Like some people were saying, well, where is my Siri logs, for example? And it's just they literally don't have them. They give you a unique ID every time you use it, and they perish that ID fairly quickly. So there's no record that you're the one who used Siri. So they can't ever give that back to you. But they give back to you the things that they are stored that are connected to your ID. Well,
and actually, that's kind of the point of this, is that companies should stop being so pack rats, collecting so much personal information. that they don't need or that they want to use. And this is what e-privacy is going to really affect. We're apparently already in the EU. We're seeing huge drops in ad tech purchases, but e-privacy is going to even.
Well, and I think that what's interesting
stronger.
Is this obviously plays heavily towards Apple and heavily away from just about all their major competitors. You know, like that it's, you know, this is something that Apple
will be the best.
They'll be the best.
Able to handle all this.
I forget who said it, but one of the Apple people said nobody cared about security until Windows XP. And
right.
Then suddenly everyone cared about security, and they felt that we were getting that way. Like with Cambridge Analytica or something, we were getting that way with privacy.
Right.
Well, what we're seeing here is the difference between having absolutely no regulation. Here's what a business or an industry will do with absolutely no restrictions placed on them by any outside agency, and how hard it is to redefine an entire business once a society has decided that no, this is not going to do anymore. We can't trust you. I was reading a lot of coverage in Adweek that's really, of course, very relevant, saying that there are a lot of ad agencies that are just going to have to go out of business because it's just not possible to conduct digital ad sales or digital, basically tracking and forensics of ad impressions the way that business has been built up. that you're going to see a bunch of these servers try to change over to a more traditional sort of like newspaper or magazine thing, where instead of targeting you specifically because they know that you like to kayak and now it's springtime and now you might want to buy a kayak, they're going to have to go back to, okay, this person is a reader of the New Yorker. I'm going to start advertising, I don't know, wool blazers with leather patches and tobacco pipes, because I think the New Yorker reader does to do that.
And just hope and pray. Actually, this is really good for us, because anybody who does that kind of advertising that isn't highly targeted using ad tech has been at a disadvantage. It's harder and harder to sell against Google and Facebook, because I can't tell our advertisers. You know, when Wink comes to us, they say, well, do your people drink wine? I said, I don't know. I think so.
But it was like brand advertising. It wasn't like, there was this whole thing with trackers. Like, trackers started because ad companies said, oh, we have the internet now, we can monitor people, and I don't want to pay to show Leo this ad 7 times, because if he hasn't bought it after the 7th time, he's never going to buy it, and I'm wasting my money. And so they would try to track you and figure out, oh, we've shown him this 7 times, show him a different ad. But in reality, a lot of these companies, like, if you're not going to buy a Toyota today, and Samsung is great at this, they want to make sure you're so blanketed in their brand that the next time you do want something, you automatically think of them.
But wouldn't it
lost so much of that.
I'm not sure it's such a good thing, even though I benefit from it. I don't like seeing ads for stuff I'm not interested in. I don't want to see an ad more than 7 times if I'm not going to buy it. So some of those things seem like a good thing.
Well, and I also think that
trackers are onerous.
Trackers, well, maybe, but yeah.
But I think that when you're building that also for small companies, it's key, because, you know, they don't have the money to carpet bomb, you
That's
know,
right.
an entire
it
country.
Makes advertising more efficient.
Yeah. If you look at, like, you know, we're launching a studio in DC, and so we're looking at Facebook, you know, and our thing, Facebook and Google AdWords, I can say, okay, I'm only looking for the city, and I'm only looking for people who are interested in these things that would possibly need a studio, and I'm only looking for the people, you know, like, and I can kind of tie that all up. Now I'm going to spend money only on the people that I'm looking for. I'm not sending it out to everyone.
Thing.
But I think that,
why would anybody want to see an ad for something they don't want? Right.
Right.
But if only it were just about ads. My real difficulty with unrestricted tracking is that now there are companies that pretend that they're going to apply scientific principles to marketing and profiling to be able to tell a potential employer, tell me all about this Andy Anatko. Who is he? What's he interested in? What should we be worried about? If when it comes to time to buy a house, that credit score is very good. Oh, well, he's a freelancer, so why don't we just take a look? Oh, this phony baloney quote analytics company that has thrown a lot of words like machine learning at us says that he's very, very likely to grow a beard and decide to become a fur trapper by the age of 54. And that's right in the middle of the loan period, so we shouldn't loan it to him. That's the difficulty, I think, of all this stuff, where you don't know how this information is going to be used, whether it's legitimate information or, again, phony baloney stuff that is being marketed as parts of sewer science.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge. I think it's good for the economy, and it's good for end users if it's used, advertising. I think it's a good thing.
I think overall, all
so
of this
what,
is
why
good for
what the laws should users. Really say is restrict the use of it to, you know, in certain ways, but they're not.
Also,
doing
the implementations
that.
Are horrible. That's what leads to the 5 gigabyte web page, 5 megabyte.
Yeah,
web
no,
page
I agree.
Is all the trackers
yeah.
are
no. It's clear ad tech brought this upon itself, and the surveillance capitalism brought it upon itself. But it's a shame, because I think. And again, it's good for me because we don't use ad tech, and so.
Well, and I think one of the tricky ones is for instance.
But I don't want to sell inefficient ads, and I feel like it would be better for us if advertisers knew that they were advertising the right people and their ads worked better. I could charge more for an ad. It would be good for everybody, but that isn't going to happen because people are so squirrely about privacy.
Well, and I think that. E-privacy, again, I think is going to be the one that's much more complicated. So, for instance, one of the things that...
Here's legislation currently provides one condition under which a company may use data or metadata about users' electronic communications. You have to obtain explicit and informed permission for a specific or agreed-upon purpose. Otherwise, you can't collect the data, but you must still offer the same services.
That's the tricky part.
So if you're WhatsApp... This is specifically targeted at companies like WhatsApp. And, you know, if you're WhatsApp, you have to say, okay, we would like to collect metadata and location data and so forth. And this is exactly why we want to use it, not for Andy's purposes, not for the insurance companies, but because we want to sell advertising. And you have to agree to it. And WhatsApp, if you even if you say, no, you can't do that, WhatsApp still has to offer WhatsApp a free service to you in exactly the same form.
Which is interesting, because every time I get a new Android phone or I do an update, I always go and turn Google Assistant on, and it says, can we monitor your web and app activity? And I say no. And it says, well, you can't use Google Assistant. And I, every time I'm like, well, there's still others. You could tell me what the temperature is if you're not monitoring my app or my web
activity. No, they have to know your location to tell you what your temperature is.
No, right? Location is fine. I just don't want them monitoring my web. But they don't give me that choice. It's all or nothing. Right. And this might force them to give me a choice of, I'll share this data to get these features, but I won't share that data, understanding that I won't get those features.
The big deal is that this is the separation between the user having no rights to the user finally having some rights. For instance, it's not just about ad tracking. It's about things like one of the things that might keep you in Spotify and not moving to Google Play or to Apple Music is that, well, I've got all these playlists and I've got all my favorites. Part of this is saying that is a guarantee of data portability, so that if your data is all on one service, they have to give you a way to get that data out and use it on another service should you choose to leave. It also includes ways to create class action suits against companies that powers that are very, very explicitly stated at a level that's much, much higher than whatever agreement that the company wants to sign you up for. So there's a lot of good stuff here. I'm sure there's going to be some wobbling over the next year or two as we figure out stuff that is just so impractical that it needs some modification. But again, the difference between no rights whatsoever and some rights, and the ability for the EU to really put the hurt on even a company like Google and Facebook, that's a landmark step.
Well, the question is can Facebook, under e-privacy, keep you from having an account if you're not using your real name? Because right now they can, right?
It doesn't work very well.
But like there's all kinds of verification processes. You know, for instance, if you want to live stream, it used to be if you wanted to live stream on YouTube, you would have to, you know, put in more your phone number, you know, to certify. Would they not be allowed to do that? And those aren't issues around trackability. They're around issues of we want to make sure that we know who is actually using the product for liability reasons. And for instance, YouTube is a good example of the reason that YouTube comments for a live stream, for instance, are completely useless is because everybody has a handle. You know, in Facebook, it's a lot better because everybody's got a name. You know, and so the thing is there are management processes. Are if I can't do that, is that going to now, you know, create more chaos, you know, for the actual user who's trying to enjoy the show, so to speak?
I had to give a phone number to get a Gmail address yesterday.
Right.
And I was thinking about it, but then I'm like, do I want people to be able to make unlimited Gmail addresses who aren't real people? I don't know. I don't know the answers to a lot of stuff.
I suspect what's going to happen is you're going to see fewer free apps and more paywalls. And you're going to be paying for
paywalls
more stuff.
Don't scale. I mean, like you can, in the old days, you go to a newsstand and you'd see a bunch of papers and you'd choose the one you'd like and you buy it. But now you're supposed to subscribe to all these papers and then all these services like Netflix and Hulu and the Washington, you know, Washington Post and the New York Times and Apple Music and Spotify. And it just, it doesn't scale. And
well, I don't like it either, but that's what you're going to get. I think that's just what you're going to get.
And again, I wonder if
welcome to the new world. The EU has now insisted that ad tech die. It's going to die, and that's.
And I also wonder whether if I'm a startup, whether I just say I'm going to block the EU when I start up because not large enough. It's not large enough of a market for like the if I have something that I think is going to be successful in the rest of the world or the US specifically. Do I just say I'm going to block that for now? If we're successful, I'll figure out how to manage that later. Or maybe I never.
That's why
do.
I wonder if those newspapers really will care. Ever stop blocking the EU because they don't care because advertisers aren't paying for EU readers.
A lot of U.S. advertising doesn't like they don't care about global advertising, and so the question is, does it become
the
much
Arizona
more
Star? Centric? I guarantee you does not sell ads based on the number of people in the EU that read it. Mm-hmm. So those guys are free riding already. No problem cutting them off. Mm-hmm. The problem is it does make an issue. I had a caller on Saturday said, I want to post an article from the Arizona Star on Facebook and it says you can't. And I thinking that that's because the Star doesn't know whether its content will be viewed in the EU on Facebook. And so is doing some sort of sharing block. That's going to be a problem for them.
Right.
I think what's happening, look, I understand, and you know, yeah, so now people have privacy rights. But what we don't see on the other side of it is what the consequences are going to be. And I think it's a very different internet. It's not how the internet was built, and it's going to be a very different internet. And, you know, we'll see.
I guess the question is that we can, I think one of the things would be similar to, like, we're suddenly being stopped every 10 miles for our ID, which I've been in countries where you are stopped every 10 miles right. for your ID. And it's annoying. You know, like, you know, and I think that it, and it does, you know, slow things out. Now, it does keep everybody protected in those countries that I've been in. They do that because they want to make sure that there's no terrorists and there's all this other stuff. But it is a pain in the neck to have to stop and be in a line every 10 miles. And so, but I think that those are the kind of things that's what this is almost creating at the beginning. I think that they'll find something in the middle, but I do think that it could be messier than Y2K.
Well, it's interesting, though, because, like, I had a conversation with some of the people who make this ad tech back when content blockers were a thing and everyone was nervous that content blockers would do exactly this. And, you know, these are smart companies. It's like Google Ad Exchange, and they could care less about the quality of their ads. Like, we've found out there's no money in making better quality ads. Sometimes the worst ads convert better. And the entire industry was apathetic to the people who were at the end of their ads.
Sorry. And now, this is the consequence. You got what you...
There was absolutely zero respect for the end user.
And frankly, I think ad blockers, I think, are not gone. I think they're only getting worse. I think that's another thing that hasn't really fully played out yet. Certainly, our audience, I would say the majority use ad blockers. You know, so again, all of this is great for us, you know, but I don't know if it's great for advertisers, and I don't know in the long run how it's going to play out for, bad for most content players like iMore, and I don't know how it's going to play out for end users, because I don't know what the internet's going to look like after, you know, when this comes to its logical conclusion. Will WhatsApp be free? If they can't monetize, will it be free?
I think it is now, isn't it? Didn't they remove the 99 cent thing a while ago?
It's basically free.
Yeah.
But will it stay that way? And how much are you worth to it? So how much will they charge per user? 99 cents seemed a fair price, one time only, right? Or was it a year? I guess it was a year.
Yeah.
Skype is free.
Although Skype credit, like if you want to do certain things, like you want to get Skype credit for it. But,
right. Right.
It's interesting because
a freemium model might survive, right? I think it would.
Buy sticker packs and that supports the app.
Yeah.
I do think it's an interesting stratification, you know, because now I know that I get these things that pop up for New York Times and Washington Post, and now I just don't. If I see it in Flipboard, that is Washington Times, or I just flip past it.
Bloomberg,
I'm like, oh, I don't want to deal with
Bloomberg
that.
Bloomberg wants $35 a month. I just can't. I'm not going to pay it.
I just skip all of those. You know, I just like, I'm not going to pay that.
And yet Mark Gurman is not skippable. So I don't know what I'm going to do about that, right? I get 10 articles. There's a little flaw in their logic because I get 10 articles per browser. It's a browser cookie. So, but if they lock that one down, $35 a month is outrageous. I'm not going to pay $35 a month for Bloomberg.
I can see all this coming to Canada, but do you think it would come to the U.S., something similar to these regulations?
No.
No.
Never.
No.
It's antithetical to everything we stand for in this great country.
the one thing we've got on our side is the fact that Facebook and Google are a monopoly on the ad business. And if they can figure out a way to give privacy rights to individuals in a way that works within their model but will not work within anybody else's ad model, then they will start to basically promote this and lobby this and saying, well, gosh, if Google and Facebook, they know what they're doing, and sure, let's get behind this. And they can, just like Apple is able to really bang the drum on, oh, well, you don't understand how much privacy is being leaked out. You don't understand how much companies are monetizing. Again, that is a big principle for them, but that also works very well for them. Google and Facebook could do the exact same thing. We're already seeing Google do something like that by saying, well, we've got this, we're in Chrome is going to have this brand new this new ad blocking technology that doesn't block all ads. It just block ads that we deem to be naughty, or I'm sorry, the industry, totally independent industry coalition, has developed a list of 10 no-nos that they built basically based on the no-nos that we suggested that they adopt. But hey, they're still the industry no-nos, and we're going to subscribe to their no-nos and make sure that those ads don't go in. And again, these are ad types that Google is not really interested in right now or can easily adapt to deal with. Whereas other ad networks, it just basically torpedoes them. So that's part of the problem with this is that you have,
and this is really the, I think, going to be the real issue. The internet, which is a global entity, is regulated by individual countries in ways that impact everybody. So GDPR impacts everybody, whether or not the U.S. will ever do it. Here's another example. Russia is now demanding that Apple remove Telegram from the Russian App Store. Russia's been doing a lot to ban Telegram, blocking IP addresses, all sorts of stuff, because it's encrypted. They wouldn't provide backdoor access to Russia. So now Apple's, again, in the position of doing something Russia wants it to do, just like they were doing something China wanted it to do. I imagine Apple will comply. I don't know why they would do anything different in Russia that they do in China. This is kind of a problem. While I appreciate GDPR, and I think in many ways we get benefits from it,
I guess I wonder also whether we're going to see a lot of the impact. I mean, I have a friend, for instance, that sells a little product, and he, you know, he said, you know, you put a certain amount of money into AdWords and you get a certain amount of sales back, you know, and it's one of those things. It's not like he's got this big, he's not Google and he's not Facebook, but he is making, you know, he's putting $4,000 of advertising in, getting $8,000 back every month, you know, in this little model that he has to sell his product that people like. You know, I'm not going to get into what the product is, but it's, anyway, the point is that, for all those little companies that zeroing in makes a difference, it's not just Google that's going to be affected. It's going to be a lot of companies that have very effective advertising campaigns that aren't, you know, Cambridge Analytica or anybody else. They're like little mom and pops. They're that are going to be basically run over because of all of this. And I think that that's going to be the next set of news that we start seeing 6 months or a year down the road.
Yeah. Steam users, gamers who really were thrilled by the idea of playing their desktop Steam games on iOS, bad news. You won't be able to. Apple has rejected Valve's Steam Link app. Now, I'm hearing conflicting reasons for it. Valve said Apple, which had originally approved it for release on May 7th, sent them a note saying, due to business conflicts with app guidelines, I'm not sure what that means, that the original review team had not seen. Valve appealed and has lost the appeal. I think Phil Schiller said, I don't know what Phil said, something.
They're working with Valve to try to, exactly.
We're going to fix it. What do you think the real reason is? Why is Steam Link being blocked?
There could be a lot of different categories here. There's content. There's the content itself, some of which is quite explicit, because it is an open.
Yeah, but it's a game I already own on my desktop.
But that's
I already bought it. So who are you protecting me from?
This, we've seen this play out so many times before. Like, remember the early days of content controls in the App Store, where you say, well, the reason that someone could actually visit a website off of this app and that website might have explicit content on it.
You can maybe justify, but this stops me from playing a game on my desktop that I already bought and own.
What I'm saying is that I think this was a level one or level two kickback, and then once the company has an open and frank discussion with Apple, then people who are a lot more poised to make nuanced decisions take a look at it. I think this will get wrapped up. I think part of it might be simply membership fees. Part of it might be the idea that it is the Steam's big thing is that, well, this is just like any other like VNC sort of app. All we're doing is we're opening a connection to a remote computer. I'm sure it's not as dire as that. I think they made a huge tactical mistake by saying that, oh, they're banning us because it's an incompatible business sort of thing, which would invite people to think, oh, well, Apple doesn't want competition from their own games in the App Store, when actually it's probably nothing like that. So we'll hold tight for a month. I'm sure it'll get settled out very quickly.
I think the business conflict was that there were in-app purchases that Apple didn't get 30% of actually what it was.
We could wind up with a Comixology sort of thing where the app will be there, but it will be impossible to make purchases. I think the original version, there was possible to make purchases on your Steam account where the money wasn't going through Apple somehow.
Yeah, it actually required kind of a hackery workaround by the end user.
Well, this is the way Audible works, right? You have to buy your book
on the
website.
Which makes it much less useful than the Audible on Android, where you can buy it directly.
It's so annoying. Like, you go, oh, I want a book, and it is, now go to your webpage, and you're like, oh.
And that only applies for digital goods, not for real life goods. There's no whole prohibition on real life.
Here's Schiller's email, which was posted on Reddit. Unfortunately, the review team found that Valve's SteamOS iOS app, as currently submitted, violates a number of guidelines around user-generated content. Maybe that's the, you know, adult stuff. In-app purchases, content codes, etc. Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe it doesn't reflect the content code. Although, again, it only lets you play apps you own on your desktop.
There's weirdness with Apple, too. Like, I know a lot of games that have coupon codes that you can type into the game to get. You can't run those on iOS the way you can on Android. They just don't have that system in place.
I think these things
usually end one of two ways. It's usually like Apple has made some dumb decision and then they walk it back. Or there's something going on that we're not immediately aware of. There's some, you know, the connection's not as secure as Apple wants it to be.
Right.
Or there's some possibility that a kid will buy something they shouldn't buy, and then Apple will be in the middle of a litigation lawsuit. And either way, it tends to get wrapped up pretty quickly. Like
I think I'm going to guess that Apple's going to continue to work with Steam to figure this out until Steam gives up.
Yeah.
No, like I don't think, you know, like, no. No, I think they're going to be like, let me, we're going to give you a ton of communication and go, no, but we're working with you. And then Steam's just going to go, this isn't worth it.
Yeah.
The problem is that it's too, it is too competitive with the game. I don't think Apple's looking at Steam. I think Apple's looking at every game developer on the iPhone. Which is, you know, that, or Valve, I mean, I don't mean Steam. Thank you for Beatmaster. But with Valve, they're looking at all of the game developers because games are a big deal on the iPhone, and, you know, having them be native is something that is important to Apple. I think that's what this all comes down to.
It
Apple will
just
use a
crappy
excuses.
Experience. It is available for Windows on Xbox, for instance. You could play Xbox games on Windows.
Mm-hmm. But I think Valve, this rollout of Valve on the iPhone or on iOS would be devastating to the current game developers, and I think that it would, because it works really well, and I think that Apple will use a bunch of excuses to drag this out until Valve decides to go do something else. You know, like I think it's a non-native. Development. If this is really successful, I mean, and I'm not saying this is the way it should be. I'm just saying I think this is the way it is. So I think that you're basically moving all your game development into a non-native platform away from your platform. If I was Apple, I'd find every way to avoid having that happen because it pushes a huge part of their business out of their platform.
What's funny is when in-app purchases first came out, you know, Apple, that was Apple's worry that everyone would make everything free and then it would have a button to buy from their website. And it would cut Apple completely out of the revenue stream. And that might sound fine, but Apple would be then supporting every one of these free apps for free, like all the transactions, the downloading, the storage, all of that. And there would be no, right now the paid income dwarfs, you know, the cost of supporting this for free. But if almost everyone can figure out a way to go free and to save that 30%, they'll do it. And then there's no app store economy. So when they moved to allowing free apps to have in-app purchases, they disallowed sort of the direct buy because, you know, Comixology would be free, but you'd be buying everything from Amazon. So Apple gets zero revenue. The game would be free, but you'd be making all the in-app purchases directly with EA or Valve or whomever, and Apple making $0 off that purchase. And I think Alex is right about this. If there's a way to wholesale move the platform off of iOS but still access iOS customers, Apple feels like they're then maintaining the store that they're no longer generating any income for. And it's sort of like setting up a pop-up store inside Walmart that then you keep everything from the pop-up store.
Right.
And that's not, simply not in Walmart's best
and
future.
Moving on. I just want to say one thing. Can I say one thing?
One thing.
It's not like putting a pop-up store into Walmart. It's like putting another Walmart into Walmart. Games are a huge, you know, games are a huge part of the revenue of the App Store. So it's not, it's like putting a door in Walmart that is a whole other Walmart on the other side.
This way, to our store. Yeah. That's a good point. Lucy, you got some splaining to do. U.S. District Court Judge Lucy Coe maybe gave away some secret information. There's a lawsuit going on about touch disease. You know, that the Apple knew about touch disease before it told the, you know, people or whatever. And this lawsuit, there were some internal Apple. These are why lawsuits are bad for Apple, the secrecy kings. Some internal Apple documents were filed under seal in that lawsuit that alleges Apple misled customers about touch disease. They're still under seal, but Judge Coe inadvertently, I would guess, made some of the information public in a recent opinion on the case. She, and this is the pleading with the smoking gun, Apple's internal testing determined the iPhone 6, and she quotes this, so this comes from the documents, was 3.3 times more likely to bend than the iPhone 5S, and the iPhone 6 Plus was 7.2 times more likely to bend than the 5S. And she uses this to underscore that, you know, Apple sometimes knows about this stuff but doesn't disclose. This was before, more likely to bend easily when prepared to, before they shipped it. So this isn't even related to the touch disease, but.
Yeah, so, I mean, this has been reported in really weird content. Yeah, so, the way it works is, Apple moves materials, and they have a whole materials department, and it's their job to weigh concerns with capability. So, for example, when they moved from aluminum to plastic with the iPhone 3G, they knew that plastic is more likely to crack than aluminum, but it had other characteristics they liked, and lo and behold, iPhone 3G's cracked, and they got better with iPhone 3GS. Then they moved to glass with the iPhone 4, and again, they knew that glass is more likely to break than the plastic was, but it gave them characteristics they wanted, and people would drop them, and now they'd break on two sides. And the same thing happened with iPhone 6. Apple knows, you know, because again, this is physics, that metal bends the way that glass, you know, ceramic shatters, metal bends. They probably didn't realize it would be the extent that it was, or that it would have other effects like the touch disease. And so when they realized this, they made iPhone 6S even better than iPhone 6. But these are, it sounds sinister, we're going to let everyone's iPhones bend. But it really is the cost of changing materials in a product that ships in hundreds of millions, and then you're always playing catch up with the next generation.
Although they must have been just a little disconcerted when, day one, somebody bends it.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that, on
I
YouTube. Think,
you can sure,
I thought we'd have a month just, or two before.
I really didn't like the headlines here. I really didn't like the way the story is being told. I mean, when you read the actual court document, what they're saying is that Apple, not being idiots, was aware that the iPhone, these stories don't mention what the iPhone 4 and the iPhone 5 design was, a solid aluminum frame going all the way around the entire outer edge of the device with two panes of glass that they're making it super, super, super stiff as well. So basically what they're saying is that when they decided not to have this thick aluminum frame around the entire phone, they were aware that this was not going to be as strong as the previous one. And so if that is a complaint, then the complaint is that Apple should always make phones that are stronger than the one that came before. So it leaves open the idea that they thought it was still plenty strong, just of course not going to be as strong as this previous design, which was, as Renee said, was designed that way for a number of reasons, and strength was probably not the number one reason, or probably was a sacrificeable reason. And then the second complaint was that, aha, and then to prove that here's the smoking gun, they redesigned it later on to make it less bendable. Which, again, if you're a little bit less conspiracy-oriented, it's that they took advantage of the fact that now they've seen tens of millions of these things in the wild, and they have determined, they can now see where this thing fails on a scale of millions of things in the wild as opposed to thousands of things in the wild. And, well, I'll be darned, they decided to make it stronger without having to redesign the whole damn thing. So, yeah, I mean, it did point out that whereas there was a lot of laughter about, oh yeah, look, if you bend your phone like this and you're stupid enough to bend it like that, well, take better care of your phone. The more nuanced and more interesting thing to point out is that we have a lot of people that weren't aware that they were bent, that in their pocket the phone was bending just enough not to cause a visible wobble in the phone, but to unseat certain pieces of circuitry that would cause that touch disease. And that was one of the things that Apple was addressing in this redesign. But this is another thing where the headline wrote itself before I think anybody really read what was being talked about here.
She must be so tired of Apple by now.
I have to say that I've had all these phones. I haven't bent any of the phones. And one of the primary things that I don't do is I don't put them in my back pocket.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you could put that a phone, you know, this big or bigger into your back pocket and sit on it and not expect to break it is kind of absurd to me, you know, at least bend it a little bit. There's a certain level of understanding physics that I think people, you know, I just feel like sometimes these lawsuits are an excuse for being an idiot. You know, and so, wow. The thing is that, you know, putting them in your back pocket is a silly thing to do. And I the last time I put them in my back pocket, admittedly, was the smaller phones. But once they got bigger, it seemed like an obvious thing. And it's fine for you to put it in your back pocket, and it's fine for you to break it. It's just not fine for you to blame Apple.
You could actually argue that the reason it got bent so fast is because people looked at it and said, oh, look, I bet this will bend.
Well, also,
obvious, right?
That if you put it in your back pocket and then a week later you put it on the table and you notice it's wobbling, say, oh my God, I shouldn't be putting it in my back pocket. It's different when you visibly nothing bad is happening and then something very, very subtle happens later on where why is the screen no longer working? Why is this button no longer working?
Right.
And you don't really correlate it with a behavior that you should have terminated on day two.
On day zero. I think part of it is also, treating 600 or 800 or $1,000 items like they're 600 or 800 or $1,000.
You haven't met my kids.
No. I have this argument. I will admit, I have this argument with my wife who will constantly put her eight, whatever plus in her back pocket. And I'm always just kind of like, if that breaks, I'm not buying you a new one. I'm giving you a 5C.
I tell my kids.
So
Abby's using a Samsung phone now.
Yeah.
Poor kid.
Now that it's summer weather again. Do you keep your phone in your front in your front shirt pocket, knowing that it'll get your body's going to sweat and that moisture is going to sort of condense on the surface of the phone, and again after weeks and weeks and weeks, hey, it's still working, this must be perfectly safe. And then then 5 or 6 months later, when something starts to fail and they open it up and say, well, yeah, there's been moisture ingress, and given by the smell of Irish Spring inside this phone, we're guessing it was body sweat perspiration that made this happen. At that point, you can't really call someone an idiot because, again, they're looking for cause linked directly to effect. It's hard to link behavior that over time the odds start to creep up on you. So I think the suit is silly, but who knows?
I have some visitors in the studio from Portugal. Nice to have you. And they say I have been pronouncing Três Pontais wrong all this time. How do you say it? I was saying it's Spanish, and it's, of course, Portuguese. It's from Brazil.
So instead of the sibilating S, more of a sh.
Sh. Três Pontas. Três Pontas. However you say it, it is amazing coffee, because you will agree with this. The best coffee comes from Brazil. Absolutely. They got coffee in the coffee in Brazil. Let me tell you, folks, we're big fans. We've been drinking Três Pontas. For a couple of months now, exclusively. It's the official coffee of Twit and my house, too. It's actually a great story. It's a single-family farm in Brazil, in the Três Pontas area of Brazil. They, the Reis family, they've been growing coffee for 100 years. It's multi-generational, three generations. Some of the best premium gourmet coffee in Brazil, where some of the best coffee in the world is grown. There's some advantages, actually. This is the first time they've ever exported it to the U.S., by the way. And I want to say, one of the things we all know about great coffee, besides starting with really good beans, you got to have it fresh roasted. And this is so smart. Três Pontas Coffee, the Reis family, ships it to the U.S. green, and then it's roasted here in the U.S. So, look, this was roasted May 21st, and we've had it for a few days. So you're going to get fresh, great coffee. I love this feature. On the back of every Três Pontas bag is a QR code. I'm going to take a picture of the QR code here. And let me see. And then it'll show you on a map where your beans came from. Right there. That right there. There's the bush. That's. I love that. Do you want to know where your coffee came from? That's where it came from. So single farm sourced 100% Arabica whole beans, non-GMO, certified kosher. Picked by hand, roasted in small batches. Oh, there's one more thing. Coffee in Brazil doesn't have to be washed. A lot of coffee coming from more equatorial countries where it's hotter has to be washed because of mold. They don't have that problem. So Três Pontas is naturally pulped, not washed. And what does that mean? It means you get a smoother. I'm going to open this bag so you can see these beautiful beans. You get a smoother brew. It is fan. Oh man. Oh boy, does that smell good. It is a fantastic. These are the dark roast, I guess. Just a fantastic. And the pulp is still on there. And that means that the brew is smoother than the washed beans you'll get everywhere else. Get freshly roasted beans sent to you on as you need them. 1, 2, or 4 weeks. 12-ounce bags. I like the idea of getting a smaller amount shipped more often. That way, And shipping is free, so you don't have to worry about that. In the U.S., it's free shipping. So I like the idea of getting it shipped more often. That way, you always have a fresh bag. Light, medium, dark, and French roast. Let me open the medium because these are such beautiful coffees here. This is the medium roast. Or should I do the light? Show you the light. I shouldn't open all these bags, but I guess I don't have to worry. It will be drunk. You had some, didn't you? Right? It was good? Did you like it? All right. Tres Pontas. Here's the deal. If you sign up for a subscription, which I recommend, if you do sign up for a subscription, you're going to save 10% off every bag of coffee. And because you're watching Mac Break, we're going to get you an extra 10% off. So here's the deal. You go to Trespontas, TrespontasMacBreak. And if you use the code MacBreak, an additional 10%, that means 20% off every bag. 20% off. By the way, for Father's Day, what a great gift, a freshly roasted coffee subscription from the Race Family Farm. From their dad to yours. Oh, that's so good. You'll actually be tempted to eat them. They're so good. You can also order on Amazon, but if you want that 20% off, you got to go to Tres Pontas. I say it that way so they can spell it. Trespontas. That means 3 points, right? Yeah, because it's a mountain. You see it right there on the logo with 3 points. Tres Pontas, trespontas.com/MacBreak. Yeah, did I get that right? Use the offer code MacBreak, and it's going to be the best coffee you ever had. And Dad is going to love it. And I'm a dad, so I can say that. Dads like coffee, right? If not, get them some wine.
The kids.
Or get them both.
Its name is Pontas. Trish Pontas.
Trish Pontas. Yeah. As somebody said, say it like Sean Connery would say it. You'll get it right. Trish Pontas. Renee Ritchie, that was my pick of the week. What's yours?
So my pick of the week, I'm going to have to turn this to see if you can see it. So bear with me. I'm turning the camera so that hopefully you can see the window here.
Yes.
Now all I'm going to say is, hey, Siri, close the living room blinds.
No.
It's fantastic.
And here they come. That is actually really great. And you could tie that to a routine, couldn't you? So that you could say, you know, like, I'm going to bed or something, and we'd do all of it.
Oh, Leo, you can do so much. In HomeKit, you can have, like, the one accessory do it. We just turn. Hey, Siri, open the living room blinds.
That is pretty cool. Who are these? Are these some particular company?
These are the Lutron Serena blinds. And what's so cool about them is that you can just say open the blind or close the blind. You can assign them to a room. So I have two blinds assigned to the living room.
Oh, this
room.
Is what those guys were crawling around doing last week. Okay.
Yes. And you have zones. So you can say the living room and the dining room are part of the main floor or the basement zone. And then you can just say close the basement blinds. You also have automation. So you can say when the motion detector detects me getting out of bed, open the living room blinds so that they're open by the time I get there.
Nice.
And these are blackout blinds. So you can set scenes too. So I can say movie time and it'll close the blinds, turn the lights to what I want, boot up the stuff that I want. But you can just lose yourself in this. I'm not doing everything with them yet, but just the ability to stand there like Tony Stark and just ask Jarvis to do all these things. I've seen them in demos before, but just getting them is so much fun. I mean, they're almost Alex expensive, so they're not for the faint of heart. But if you do sort of want to take your home automation to the next level.
That's the best thing about Japanese hotel rooms.
They all have
buttons to lower the blinds.
Right.
Now you don't so you can get button. Translucent ones and blackout ones. You can get whatever they have a whole wide variety.
SerenaShades.com. Siri enabled blinds from Lutron. I think this is what Stacey Higginbotham got that fixed her blinds issue, because she had blinds that never did quite work. Nice.
And these are battery powered, so you do have to change the batteries when they run out, but hopefully that won't be for a while.
SerenaShades.com. Andy?
I've got a tentative pick. it's an app called, a photo app called Photo Lemur.
Oh, I love Photo Lemur.
Yeah.
I use all of their stuff. This is from Mac Fun.
It is now part of Skylum Software.
They renamed. They renamed because they make Windows stuff, so they couldn't call themselves Mac Fun.
Right, right.
So it's Skylum.
But it's been around for a while. Yeah. It's really cool. Now, a lot of people who use like purpose-built cameras, you know, like Sony's, Nikon's, whatever, they complain that the pictures that this camera takes aren't half as good as the ones that were taken by their iPhone, and that's because their iPhone does a lot of intelligent processing to make the skies look blue. They identify faces and do different sort of processing on the faces. Photo Lemur is really cool because it brings that kind of smarts to automatic processing of not only your phone pictures, but essentially pictures that come from anywhere. So you can get all the advantages of having a purpose-built camera, big sensor, good light sensitivity, zooms, flashes, but also get, without having to do a lot of twiddling around in Apple Photos or Lightroom or anything like that. And it's going to be bigger and bigger. There's a new version coming out just next month, a version 2.3. I'm recommending definitely you download it because it's very, very simple. It's just one step. It just does some percolating and then shows you what it looks like. The only control that you have over it is that there's a simple left to right slider that lets you decide how much are you looking at the photo as shot versus how much are you looking at the 100% enhanced version that Photo Lemur came out with. Maybe the Photo Lemur version is a little bit too intense. You want something that is a little bit closer to original. So you just push that slider back a little bit. But the other cool thing is that if you're on vacation and you've just shot like 400 pictures, you are not going to sit there. Even if you're in like Apple Photos, clicking auto, clicking auto, clicking auto, you can just drag all of them into this app. It'll process all of them and spit them back out again. And then if you want to, if you want to be a little bit more hands-on, then go into Photos or Lightroom and adjust them a little bit more the way you like. But the thing is, even if you are that hands-on, 80% of it will be pretty much done for you. It'll be so close that the only difference is going to be what you personally like, what your taste in pictures is. I came across it just last week because I have 200 pictures from roller derby last weekend, and I love editing 5 photos. When it comes to taking 200 pictures that were taken inside like a very badly lit indoor ice arena with bad fluorescent lighting, it's like, I wish there were a tool that could do all of this for me automatically. And Photo Lemur was the app that I really, really liked. So I did wind up buying it. You can get a deal right now if you buy it ahead of the new version coming up in June. And so I decided to definitely go for that.
Well worth it. This is, Scott Bourne is on the board of Skylum. And and of course, Trey Radcliffe did the Aurora HDR, their HDR app. So this company is good. They do photo. I actually have been slowly moving over all my stuff from Adobe to Skylum stuff because it's very good and it doesn't have a monthly subscription fee and it doesn't force me to use that crappy new Lightroom.
Does it manage the library?
That's the thing, is the digital asset management.
They're working on a library management. I really like Luminar, and it's great for like one-off stuff. I'm really keen to see what they do when they have a library management app. Yep. What I like about Lightroom, and you can still get either the old version or the new like CC version, which is designed to be cloud-based. But when it comes down to, I have shot 1,000 pictures at roller derby, I need to weed this down to the 500 that are worth taking a look at, and then the 200 that are maybe worth editing, and then getting through all that editing really, really quickly. I just haven't found the groove for Luminar that I'm into with Lightroom, but I'm definitely everything they've done has been high, high quality. Unlike the Lightrooms, unlike the Adobe stuff, it's not platform agnostic. It really is designed. It feels like a Mac app. And so I'm really keen to see. They did acquire Photo Lemur. They also acquired the CEO of the company. They had a press release just last week about how they're creating a new like AI division. And so there's going to be a lot more. The impression I get is that Photo Lemur is going to continue as an easy to use standalone app that works with everything. But they will also be integrating some of the brains that created Photo Lemur are also going to be adding their expertise to Luminar. And that's going to be better for all people, I think.
It's going to be very interesting. Yeah.
Even knowing this, I did pay $40 for Photo Lemur because it was that good.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's very easy to use, which is
One click. Yeah. There's another tool that will give you this huge panel of buttons. Or look how sophisticated we are in auto enhancing your picture, totally losing the plot that, look, I want an auto enhance because I don't want buttons and sliders. I want, here you go, idiot. Here's a much better version of what you gave us. Thank you. Thank you, smart AI photo editor. So this is why, also lemurs are good. Lemurs are fun.
Nothing wrong with a lemur. Photolemur.com. Alex Lindsay.
So I'm pretty excited about my pick.
You are.
I think it was just released. At least I just found out about it this morning. So I was looking around. I was doing my morning research to figure out what I was going to finalize on, and this popped up. So this is related to the little scan that we were talking about that I actually tweeted out. I tweeted the
3D version. Go Alex Lindsay on Twitter, yeah, and you can see the...
But that's not what I'm recommending, at least this week. What I'm recommending is the next thing I'm going to try to apply that to, which is called FaceCap. And as far as I know, FaceCap was released very recently.
This is so creepy. I'm going to retweet your tweet because... This thing you made of me is just weird.
Now, the thing to look at that's Bella's 3D. I don't think that's available publicly yet.
This will be at some point. And yeah. You're looking at it in Cinema 4D.
Yeah, I rendered it out of Cinema 4D, and it is. But that literally, from the time I scanned you to the time I rendered, that was like 5 minutes.
And this rotates, right? You can see my left. I could
rotate it, yeah. It's all in 3D. That's a 3D model of you.
So what is this next thing going to do?
This one is called...
Oh, this is wild.
FaceCap. And if
so,
you,
here,
you,
hand
you,
me you, you the phone so I can show
it'll catch, it'll
people
grab.
How it looks. So the idea is this is going to use the front camera array on an iPhone 10. It requires an iPhone 10, and then you can see that. Show my screen if you would, please. So you can see as I'm talking, I kind of have to do it at a weird angle, unfortunately. But as I'm talking, it moves the face. So this is kind of like Animojis. But with an arbitrary head. Could you put this head on that face?
That's what I'm working on. That's why I scanned it. I want to work on it. Yeah.
That's creepy as hell.
So that's why I wanted to get it. So anyway, what's different about this and Animojis is that this is actually recording the data, and it's basically applying it as an FBX is a very standard way to transmit. So basically you can mail it. I'm using AirDrop. So what I can do is I can literally take that the animation and then wrap it
with something that
basically send it back out.
Yeah.
So what I have to do now is take the model that I shot of you and build blend shapes, and then drive those blend shapes with what you're doing with the phone.
You make it sound easy. This is not probably something.
Well, but here's the thing that's interesting about it is that for those out there that are a little geeky, once we build the model, so once I built you, I could have anybody who wanted to drive your face, which you simply need the app.
Right.
You know, so if you want, you know, like, you know,
is this better than Animoji? I mean, it looks a little bit like Animoji. Is it a little bit more?
It's using basically the same. It's all the same tech as Animoji, but Animoji doesn't export the FBX data back out to your 3D applications. So whether you're using Maya or Cinema 4D or 3D Max or whatever you're using out there, you can basically send this out into a file format that we can use. Now, the reason this, in my opinion, is very revolutionary is that now imagine I think this is going to be an explosion. This kind of technology is going to be an explosion for whether it's e-learning, corporate, or even YouTube content. You know, the hardest part of animation is the facial animation. And while this is not going to replace the animations for Thanos, which were amazing, by the way, it is not going to replace that. It's not going to be the next Gollum. But imagine having, whether it's training materials or having imagine fun little YouTube videos where you can generate, you have some basic motions for the body. But the hardest part is all that facial animation, which you can now drive in real time, export it out, put it on your character, and immediately have it all animated. I think that this kind of technology, and again, it's not that it wasn't possible before. There's plenty of facial animation, but it was a rig, and it was a thing, and it was a real technical person. Because this is using a standardized platform and a standardized output, once you build the receiving end of this in your app, for me it's Cinema 4D, for other people it's Maya, once you build that receiving app, the what comes out of this phone from anybody's phone is going to be a standardized output that can be applied to that quickly. Yes, there's a little bit of work on it, but it is it's super exciting. There's all kinds of fun content. I think that we're going to see people using this in weeks or months. could be literally daily or weekly, whether it's comedy or commentary or whatever, done in 3D, because it's now suddenly very easy to do.
How
the
about,
hardest part.
Fakes, though? I mean, is this also?
The reality is that the reality is that there's a lot of better ways to do fake stuff than this.
Right.
There are ways. You've already seen being able to use AI to drive. Drive very realistic versions of someone's face with something else. So that kind of stuff's out there already. And this is more of a, I can build a cartoon version of Leo. I could use that
somebody
model.
Would obviously not be real, but still.
But it'd be really funny. Right.
Nice.
It would still hurt your feelings deeply, Leo.
But imagine, the thing is that there's a good example is another fun thing that we could build. I mean, we'll see if we can do it, but what if we did this for everyone, get Andy and Renee and I and you, and there was a fun little VR version of us, that we could drive, little bits and pieces of it. It might not be the whole thing, the whole show, but maybe. But anyway, but the point is that there's lots of fun little bits and pieces that could be created that before was not going to be something we would do because it would be way too much work. But this is literally pick up your iPhone and do something, and it records all the audio with it. So you get the audio back. So, and we might have a better microphone and so on and so forth. But the point is that I can get all that audio back from someone anywhere in the world. I can get that data back and apply it immediately to a 3D character that I spent some time building and publish it. The next day, and I think for your kind of Samantha Bee kind of content or whatever, this could be a lot of fun.
It's very cool.
Anyway, so I think that it's
and is it free to download?
It is free to download, and it is free to download this. It's $6 or $7. Okay, by the way, which is again amazing that we've gotten to this economy that you can spend $6 for something to export facial animation. I've been doing this for a long time, and
Alex,
the first
can I describe that as suspiciously low amount of money? here's an app for. Oh, by the way, we have these powerful servers in Russia and China that will process this.
And what's great is it's processing it all on the phone. It's not even the funny thing is that it's grabbing all that because of that real time data. It's grabbing all the real time data from the phone. When I hit export, it's literally just sending it over AirDrop to my computer. There's no wait at all. And same thing with the Bellus 3D, which is what I was using to scan your face. It's all being done on the phone.
That's not available yet, but perhaps sometime in the App Store.
And I'll make it a choice when it's.
App.
No. I'll make it a pick when it's available publicly. Yeah. But it's
that was pretty cool.
And the thing is the idea that you could take $6 and export that. I mean, the first time I did it was I think that when we did it 10 years ago, it was $1,000 a minute. To have somebody else process that. That facial animation for us. And so now it's $6 on my iPhone.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm old enough and I've been doing this long enough to be really excited about cool technology. Anyway, this is a really cool one. And it's free to download. You should, if you're listening to this, just for fun, just download it. Even if you don't have a 3D app, just download it and think about the possibilities.
Think of what you could do. Think of all the things you could do.
Exactly. The future.
I'm amazed.
We were talking before. You're also old enough to have seen Westworld and Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the Stepford Wives.
Westworld
this doesn't
is a
end
modern
well.
TV show, Andy.
It's so great, though. it's great until everybody dies.
Yes.
It's kind of like Happy Cows in California.
I'm just going to have to start wearing a Guy Fawkes mask everywhere I go.
It's great until the EU gets a hold of it.
Exactly. The EU is going to be very upset about this. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Renee. Renee Ritchie's at imore.com. Find his wonderful work there, not just typewriting, but actual videography. Go to imore.com/vector.
Leo.
Yes, awesome stuff. Andy Iannacco is at Fast, often appears in Fast Company, and you can find his work at ihnatko.com, iannacco.com. Alex Lindsay's on the Twitter, and that's where he puts images of my face and other things.
Rendered.
Alexlindsay.
And your
course,
face on a plate.
Founder.
Your head on a plate.
Chief cook and bottle washer at the Pixel Core. Have a great week next week, wherever you may be.
I'm going to be sunning mostly. It's going to be in South Pacific.
Oh, is it really? Nice. Oh. We will be here. Don't forget, Monday, 10 a.m. Pacific for the live coverage of Apple's WWDC keynote. Megan Maroney and me will be talking all about it. I hope you will join us 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time. And, of course, we'll be back 1 week from today to get the panel together, to assemble and talk about what it all means. Thank you for being here. We do Mac Break Weekly Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's 1800 UTC. If you want to join us, you can in a couple of ways. You can always visit us in the studio like David and Andre did, our Portuguese friends, via Sweden. They live in Sweden now. Who knows what that means? But you can just email tickets at twit.tv. We love having you. If you want to watch live on the stream, you can do that, twit.tv/live. That's a whole different experience. You're not only watching the podcast, but the stuff that goes on in between. It's kind of the show about the show being made, I guess is the best way to describe that. Twit.tv/live. If you do that, you should join the kids in the back of the class, the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Now, once the show is made, you can always get it on demand, audio or video. Every show is at twit.tv, in this case, twit.tv/MBW. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast application, and that way you wouldn't have to worry about it. You just automatically get it every time it's available. Thank you for watching. Now it's time to get back to work because break time is over.